Well, hello and welcome to City Bible Forum. Welcome to a new year as well. If it's your first time here with us, then I hope you will enjoy the meeting. I don't know how you're feeling about 2010. For me, it feels a little bit like a freight train, that it's big and it's heavy and it's moving pretty fast and it's coming right at me. And although it's a bit terrifying looking out of the year from this point, it's also exciting. I know that it's a train that I want to be on. And joined us for our first meeting at City Bible Forum today. We're working through the book of John, and we're going to be looking at seven signs that John, who was there, wrote about. We're a short meeting. We'll just go from 12:30. People will probably roll in the next few minutes until 1 o'clock, and we're always finished by 1 as people need to get back to work. What we do is we look at a bit of the Bible. You'll find today's reading inside your handouts, and then we think about it for a while together, and if we've got time at the end, we'll have some questions and answers. But something a bit different today, I thought that given that today is quite a well-known part of the Bible, it's where Jesus turns water into wine, I thought we'd turn to someone else to do the reading for us. So we might turn to this video here and let an expert read this passage for us.
Lord, they have no more wine. And Jesus said unto the servants, fill six water pots with water. And they did so. And when the steward of the feast did taste of the water from the pots, it had become wine. And they knew not whence it had come. But the servants did. And they applauded loudly in the kitchen. And they said unto the Lord, how the hell did you do that? And inquired of him, do you do children's parties? And the Lord said, no. But the servants did press him, saying, go on, give us another one. And so he brought forth a carrot, and said, behold this, for it is a carrot. And all about him knew that it was so, for it was orange, with a green top. And he did place a large red cloth over the carrot, and then removed it. And lo, he held in his hand a white rabbit. All were amazed, and said, this guy is really good. He should turn professional. And they brought him on a stretcher, a man who was sick of the palsy. And they cried unto him, Maestro, this man is sick of the palsy. And the Lord said, if I had to spend my whole life on a stretcher, I'd be pretty sick of the palsy too. And they were filled with joy and cried out, Lord, thy one-liners are as good as thy tricks. Thou art indeed an all-round family entertainer. And there came unto him a woman called Mary, who had seen the Lord and believed. And Jesus said unto her, put on a tutu and lie down in this box. And then took he forth a saw and cleft her in twain. And there was much wailing and gnashing of teeth. But Jesus said, O ye of little faith. And he threw open the box, and lo, Mary was whole. Absolutely bananas. And Jesus and Mary took a big vow. And he said unto her, from now on you shall be known as Sharon. For that is a good name for an assistant.
Well, if you didn't guess, that reading that was written partly, at least, by Rowan Atkinson, and it's not the one that we're referring to today, is a lot older. It's 2,000 years old, and that's the main one that we'll be looking at as we go through this passage today. And I think something that came through in that talk is that people have a strong desire for a sign. They'd love to see a sign so they could have their questions answered and know about God. And often when people hear about something amazing, they just want more. It gives them a thirst for more. Show us another one. And we'll see as we go through John that that's in fact the reaction of most people. But others who see these signs are brought to a different point. I want to start by asking you a question and to ask whether you remember something. Do you remember the first time that you ever tasted alcohol? Or perhaps you might remember one of your first experiences with alcohol. I still, to this day, have a taste aversion to bourbon because of the first experience that I had with bourbon. But one of my strongest memories, early memories of alcohol was, in fact, one of my friends. It was my 18th birthday, and we all went out to Thai, and he got a little bit carried away over dinner and drank a little bit too much. Then when the party moved back to my place, he decided to take off all of his clothes and run up and down my street. Now, my neighbour was in her 80s, and she was a little bit disturbed by this, and so perhaps understandably, she called the police. Thankfully, by the time the police arrived, my friend had put his clothes back on. But the police came up to him and said, "Did you see someone running up and down this street?" And my friend Malcolm said, "Yes." "And what was he wearing?" "Well, actually, officer, he appeared to be wearing nothing at all." "And which way did he go?" At which my friend casually just pointed up the street and said, "I think he went that way." The police got back in the car and drove off in that direction, and I think my friend was very, very lucky. But perhaps you might remember one of your first experiences of alcohol. Some people have an attitude to alcohol that they won't go near it, they won't touch a drop. Other people have an attitude that perhaps they might be at the other end, that they enjoy a glass or two a day, or some people even more. But everyone in Australia, no matter what their attitude to alcohol, would agree that alcohol can be misused. Alcohol can be abused, which makes Jesus in this story a bit surprising, doesn't he? Most people would say that Jesus is on the extreme of never touching the drop, that he certainly wouldn't supply alcohol to anyone else. But when it comes to this wedding, as we're about to read about now, he shows a very different attitude. You'll find the passage there on page 2, just inside your handout, and we'll look now at lines 1-9. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Rowan Atkinson started, right? Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, back in those days, weddings didn't just happen for a few hours. Daryl, our video operator today, is getting married on Saturday, and his wedding is going to start quite early, which I think is very brave of them. They'll have to get up at about 5:30 in order to get their makeup on, or at least Daryl's fiance will have to get up that early. And then by the time you get to lunchtime, that'll be pretty much the end of it. Back in Jesus' day, weddings could go for up to a week. I knew that bucks parties were going a bit too far when I received an invitation from that same friend Malcolm, not to his bucks day or his bucks weekend, but to his bucks week. He asked me away for a bucks week. And weddings back in those days were more like that. You'd go and you'd stay at the house of one of the families, and the celebrations would just go on day after day after day. And in this story, Jesus has gone to a wedding like that. And the fact that they ran out of wine wasn't just something embarrassing. The fact that Jesus' mum comes to Jesus and says, "They've got no more wine," wasn't just an observation. This was a tragedy. It would be like asking someone over to your house for a meal and then forgetting to buy food. And in a culture that was very much based on shame, this would have been humiliating. This would have been the biggest of disasters. Jesus at first doesn't want to do anything to do with it, but in the end, he comes around. And in this story, the way Jesus reacts to this situation and the words that he speaks compare two things. First of all, this is what we're going to be looking at. First of all, he compares life with this party. He compares life with a party. and then he compares himself with fine wine. First, how is life like a party? Well, I went along on this Bucks week, and the beginning of the week was a bit lonely. It kind of, as you can imagine what it might have been like, we went up to the Central Coast, and it mainly involved, for the other guys that were there, pornography and poker. Pornography and gambling. And I'd just become a Christian recently, and so I spent most of the week out on the front balcony playing my guitar. And at first, I was there all by myself. I was just playing the blues. But then as the week went on, the porn and the poker started to lose their appeal. And by the time we reached the last day, we were all out on the balcony singing Cold Chisel. Life can be like a party, and as the party goes on, sometimes it can lose its appeal. Jesus compared in this situation life with a party. He made it clear that a life of excess has its costs, doesn't it? You can enjoy a bit too much wine today, but you're going to pay the price tomorrow. And so the solution that we found here in Perth is to measure out our wine to get the most that we can, the biggest hit, and still be able to function the next day. So my friends hit the alcohol pretty hard, but they still had a point where they stopped in order that they could actually get in the surf the next day, because that was the real reason for this trip. And the Epicureans, a group of philosophers back in Jesus' day, had made this into a science. They measured out exactly how much wine they could have without making themselves sick. They measured how much food they could stuff down their throats before it would cause them to vomit. And some people today think that this is the solution, that we need to enjoy as much as we can while minimizing the effects. Well, if that's the case, then Jesus is the key to how to make the most of life's party. Because Jesus claims that he holds the key. He holds the answer. How much is enough? They're still trying to work out whether the amount of alcohol that you can have to improve the health of your heart is actually doing damage to your liver. And they've been working on that question for years. Experts are working on that question. How much is too much? It takes perspective and it takes time for that kind of answer to come out. And Jesus claims that he is the one with the time. He is the one with the perspective to tell us. He tells us that he holds the key to how to enjoy good sex, how to enjoy alcohol to the full, how to enjoy relationships, how to make a family work, how to move wealth from being something that enslaves you to something that you're able to use as your resource. Jesus claims to hold the key. If life is a party, he's the one to show how to live it best. He's the ultimate party host. But if life is like a party, Jesus compares something else at this wedding. He compares himself with the finest wine. He compares himself with the finest wine. We see that there in lines 10 to 24. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 75 to 115 litres. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." Lainey, I might ask, can you grab a prop out of my bag? I forgot to get it out earlier on. Jesus, for the people that I've known who have not gone near wine or near alcohol, generally they've had very good reasons. Generally they've had experiences in their family that's made them decide, "I'm not going to touch this stuff." Which makes Jesus' attitude here even more surprising. Not only does he seem to suggest that he's not against wine, but he provides a lot of it to keep this party going. Now, I've just want to point you to one particular line in this, and it's what Jesus uses to produce this wine. It's there in line 10. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 75 to 115 litres. Now what we notice, John's very deliberate in what he includes in his story. He could have put lots of other things in, but he chose each of these details. And as we read it, we probably notice that this is a big jar. 75 to 115 litres, six of them, that's at least 450 litres of wine. But there's something else to notice, that these jars are the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing. Jesus doesn't just use any old jars, he uses jars that make a point about himself. What the Jews did before they ate, I mean, we still wash our hands before we eat, and that's an expression of how important we think health is, don't we? We don't want to get sick. The most important thing for the Jews of Jesus' day was being acceptable before God. And so they gave their hands a ceremonial washing, a washing that cleansed them in God's sight, that stopped them from becoming unclean in God's sight. And Jesus chose these jars to say that whatever Judaism had offered until that point, God had saved the best till last. Jesus deliberately prompted the words, "You've saved the best till now." If I came to your place and chose to turn some water into wine, it would be significant if I chose to do that not in just a carafe or a bottle, if I chose to do that in your best Ming vase. You'd probably be there thinking, "Hey, Paul, if you're going to pull party tricks at my house, then I'd rather you choose something that costs $20 rather than something that cost me $20,000. A Ming vase demands a bit of respect. And these jars that Jesus chose to use demanded respect. They were the method by which the Jews made themselves acceptable before God. Now, I've brought along a bottle of wine. I enjoy wine, but I'm not that much of a connoisseur, so I brought along one that was lent by a friend. It's Mosswood, which is down in Margaret River. It's a Merlot 2005, and apparently it's the finest winery in Margaret River, which isn't a bad region for wine. And the wine that Jesus produces prompts the comment from the head waiter, or what's he called here? He's the master of the banquet. It prompts the comment when he's surprised when he tastes it, so he calls the groom to him and says, "Why had you brought out the best stuff now? Why didn't you start with this? This is amazing, and people have trashed their palates by now. You've waited for a couple of days. People have swaddled. They've drunk too much wine, and now you're pulling out the good stuff. If I brought this bottle to your house as a host gift, I'd hope that you'd open it on the night, and I'd hope that you wouldn't open it at 10:30, but as we're beginning our food, because I'd want us to savour the taste. So let it wash over our palate to enjoy the fine wine." And the master of the banquet is saying exactly the same thing. Why have you saved the best till last? And Jesus doesn't just produce a bottle. He produces probably about $25,000 worth in modern terms. He produces 10 kegs worth of the finest of wines. He produces something that points to himself, but what it reveals about himself is something to do with abundance, something to do with the best in life. Jesus holds the key to the best in life, to making the most of alcohol, to making the most of wine, to enjoying family and relationships, to even enjoying work. And Jesus describes later on in this book that he has come that people might have life, and life to the full. Jesus claimed that he was the key to life to the full. And more than that, he claimed that he was actually life to the full in a person. Because Jesus' verdict on the meaning of life wasn't just that it's about enjoying things that have been made. His verdict on the meaning of life was that we've been created for relationships. And the ultimate relationship that we can have is with our Creator. Jesus claimed that he'd come so that people could have life, so they could have life to the full, an intimate relationship with the person who knew them best. But it wasn't just the best wine that he produced. He had those vases filled to the brim. He provides people with an abundance. What Jesus offers to us is life that lasts forever. Life where death is beaten, where the biggest problem in the world is defeated. He offers an abundance of life to people who follow him. So two comparisons. First of all, he compares life to a party in his actions, and then in his actions he compares himself to the finest wine. We're going to spend the next 6 weeks looking at signs, and in particular, this might sound a little bit obvious, but the most important thing about signs, the most important piece of information about signs, is that they point to something. It's a bit obvious, isn't it? Signs point to something. Let's have a look at the end of this passage, lines 25 to 27. This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. This sign of Jesus is most important because it's not just miraculous, it's significant. It signifies something, it points to something. Jesus' signs aren't just like a firecracker that goes off and makes everyone think, whoa, that was powerful. They're more like a street sign that is noticeable and points you to a greater reality. It points you to something, and in John, they point to us to something about Jesus. They reveal here, in these words, they reveal Jesus' glory. Now, we might talk about glory. The only time that I've heard the word glory used is on the television when someone wins a gold medal. It's a glorious victory, glory for Australia. And we're all looking forward to a bit of that in the coming weeks, aren't we? Hopefully we'll get another medal at this Winter Olympics. It's not our specialty. But the glory that Jesus reveals here, that this action reveals, isn't just greatness. It's not just the fireworks of being the fastest man on two skis. The glory that he reveals here is goodness. Well, Jesus doesn't just show his power through these actions. Jesus shows something about how good he is. He shows here that he's the best that life has to offer. And we all want a sign. I hear lots of people say, my friend Mark, when I first became Christian, said to me that he would be willing to believe that there was a God. He'd be willing to follow Jesus if God himself came down to his house and had a chat with him and showed him proof. And we all want a sign. We all desire to have answers to our questions. We'd all love to see a clear demonstration of a message from God. And I think that's a good desire. I'm a big fan of questions. I'm a big fan of skepticism, because I think that if we really pursue these things, if we pursue the truth without fear of what it might mean for us, then we will find answers. We will find, in Jesus' words, life to the full. And what my friend Mark wanted, a conversation with God, to see him do things that would demonstrate his power, he could have had. Mark could have had that. We could have had that if we'd been born 2,000 years ago in Palestine. If we'd been born 2,000 years ago in Palestine, we could have spoken to God. We could have touched Jesus. We could have asked him questions. We could have seen these amazing demonstrations of what God's like. And although we're not first century Palestinians, although we weren't there, we've got to recognize that we live in a society where we have unparalleled freedom. We live in a time where we enjoy a high standard of living. And we don't just get to see Jesus do these things and then ask ourselves, am I crazy? Was I imagining that? We get record after record of eyewitnesses who were there. We hear what John has to say, not just about this sign, but about other signs that he saw. And we hear what other eyewitnesses have to say about it. You might have questions about the reliability of John, and I think that's valid if you do. I don't believe everything that I read. I think a degree of skepticism is healthy. But my challenge to you would be to pursue through those questions without fear of what the answers might be. and you will find a truth. There's some handouts on the way. I don't want to go into the details of historical method and how you weigh eyewitnesses, but there's a handout just by the door. Let me say in brief that if you stood in a court, the most powerful testimony according to the judge would be multiple eyewitnesses, which is exactly what God has done. When we ask for a sign, if you think it through, you'll have to acknowledge that what God has given us is clear signs about who he is and what he's like. Now, this sign that we've seen today shows us what God was like. And I'd like to ask you the question, what would you have done if you were there? What would you have done if you were there? Would you have needed another sign? Would you have said, go on, give us another one? Well, there were some people who were there who in our last couple of lines, line 26, he thus revealed his glory, his goodness, his greatness, and his disciples put their faith in him. There were people there on that day, like John, who wrote this down for us, who one sign was enough. I mean, if I'm driving down the street and I see a give way sign or a stop sign, I don't wait for the next one. One sign is enough to act on if it's a clear sign. And they decided on that day that this was a man who they put their faith in, or in non-religious words, who they'd trust, who they'd entrust themselves to, who they'd choose to follow. One sign is enough. Well, Jesus is the man with everything to give. He claims that he's like the best wine. He claims that he offers us the ultimate relationship. And at the end of John's book, he describes why he's written these things down. And he says that he has written about these signs. Jesus did many other signs, but he's recorded these ones so that we might know who Jesus is. We might know that he is the King, the Christ, the one with authority. And that by believing in him, we might have life. Life to the full. Now, that leaves us with the question of how will we respond to what we've seen? What Jesus offers is life to the full, a relationship that is rich, that's worth savouring, and it goes on forever. Over the next 6 weeks, we'll be looking at more signs written by John, but just this one sign has enough to show us that we can change our response to God. It was enough for John. He chose to follow Jesus for the next 3 years of his life. And in the end, it cost him his life to follow Jesus. For me, following Jesus has been at times inconvenient. It's meant change, painful change. It's meant sacrifice. But also, it has meant a life beyond any imagination that I had before. It's meant a life where I feel that I know my Creator, and has meant a life where I feel that I know what its meaning is. Those things are worth the hard work of research. Those things are worth the hard work of time. If John's right, if these really are God's signs, then it can be a turning point that will give us life to the full. Well, we're at 1 o'clock, so if you want to catch me with any questions, please do outside. A couple of events that are coming up are on the back of your handout. Next Tuesday morning, John Anderson, who used to be the Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the National Party, is visiting Perth, and there are still some tickets available for a breakfast where he and his wife, Julia, will be talking about their life and John's leadership. Next week, we're looking at would you recognise a sign? Just the next sign that John records in his book is something that Jesus did which was very disturbing to some. He made a whip and drove people out of Jerusalem's most famous and significant landmark. Come back next week to find out more about that. Hope to see you then.